Today on Wings, Canadian producers Kristen Schwartz and Asad Ismi ponder 600 years of patriarchal capitalist violence linking European witch hunts, the Congo War, and murders of indigenous women. This is part one of the dynamic series Women, the Oppressed Majority.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
From the 15th century to the Iraq War, women have been a major target of male militarism, which is partly aimed at keeping them politically powerless and economically poor. The male subjugation of women by force has been intimately linked to the accumulation of wealth by men. Most casualties of wars are civilians, and women and children often suffer the most. National military forces are almost completely male. Currently, one-third of all women in the world suffer violence due to armed conflict. Meanwhile, in homes, schools, workplaces, and on the streets around the world, women are subjected to violence and the threat of violence as part of daily life. This includes situations of war, genocide, political repression, murder, rape, sexual assault, and intimate partner violence.
While the oppression of women has deep roots in human history, modern patriarchy was imposed worldwide through European colonialism, which began in the 11th century. Europe's endless wars were accompanied by the vicious suppression of women there. For 300 years, from 1450 to 1750, over 1 million women were tortured and burned as witches.
Tamara James is a witch. She is the High Priestess and co-founder of the Wiccan Church of Canada. We spoke with her about what motivated Europe's rulers to murder women systematically.
They didn't want women to own land in their own rights. And there were women who were widowed. There was a lot of fighting and wars and illness going on. And if a woman didn't marry so that she and her land became a man's property, then they needed to get rid of her. The other thing is that most of the medicine, certainly in the villages and towns, was being practiced by women. They were midwives and herbalists. And this is right around the time where the College of Physicians started, and the male practitioners. And they were trying to get rid of the women.
The Catholic Church needed to solidify its power, which was being challenged by heretical Christian groups. To do this, the church persecuted women as witches to spread fear among the population, which then would not dare question its authority. The repression of sexuality by the Catholic Church also played a role.
It was the sexuality of the woman that was the most dangerous thing. You know, it was firmly believed that women were insatiable sexual creatures, and that was their danger, that they could, you know, lure a man in and they would take away his power through means of their sexuality. So that was to be curbed at all cost. So when you put these things all together, you have a perfect storm for getting rid of women and inconvenient people.
Europe's rulers carried out witch burning in order to accumulate the wealth needed to fund the emergence of European industrial capitalism, which was also financed by the Western colonization of the global South.
Now, the new capitalists also were very, very invested in the New World and the Caribbean and Africa, and in the trades that were going on there, including the human trafficking, because these were ways of getting money, getting land, getting property, getting wealthy. And so you've got these robber barons, basically, that are making their money off of the misfortunes of other people, but it didn't really matter because those weren't really people.
And neither were women.
No.
Yeah, because they're property.
That's right.
So were the natives.
Same thing.
So they were both colonized at the same time.
Yeah.
In both the West and the Global South, the Western male elite socialized male power by turning it into male-dominated organizations, including militaries, governments, corporations, religions, and political parties, while individualizing and isolating women by destroying their organizations. The aim was to eradicate women as group entities on a significant social level and limit women's social influence to the family. This destructive model was enforced through colonialism, slavery, and genocide in Africa, Asia, and the Americas. The subjugation of the many peoples of the South greatly enriched the European capitalist elite and killed about 1 billion Southern women, men, and children, drastically marginalizing women worldwide.
Wherever they went, European colonizers wiped out more egalitarian societies and set up patriarchal institutions. This happened in the Caribbean, where native populations were eradicated by Britain, Spain, and France, and slaves were brought from Africa and indentured workers from India for labor, mainly on sugar plantations. The transatlantic slave trade lasted more than 400 years, from 1450 to 1870. The slave trade was so lucrative that it built the British cities of Bristol, Glasgow, and Liverpool. Alyssa Trotz is from Guyana, which is in the Caribbean. She is Associate Professor of Caribbean and Women's Studies at the University of Toronto.
So I think what we're talking about is the transplantation into the Caribbean of people from all around the world in this sort of violent and hierarchical order that is structured by European imperialism. And as I said, these relations are ones that are racialized and gendered and sexualized in the service of global capital. And what we have there, therefore, are forms of or ideas and practices around masculinities and femininities that are deeply, deeply racialized and deeply patriarchal in ways that Africans enslaved on the plantations are meant to aspire to but never able to actually achieve. So to give you an example, the definition, therefore, of femininity in that particular sort of context, in the context of plantation slavery in the Caribbean, would have been white, part of the planter class, someone who is not working, obviously, and that definition of femininity is done in contrast to an other who is seen as black. You can't aspire to domesticity because slavery requires that you work on the time of the plantation clock. Your time is not seen as your own. Your labor is not seen as your own. Your household and your family does not belong to you because you have no control over whether you wake up tomorrow and your family, who might be related to you biologically, actually is sold off the next day. So you have no control over. And it is in those spaces of incredible violence and coercion that those who are enslaved must struggle, as they always do.
After European imperialists enslaved and worked to death millions of Africans on Caribbean plantations, Britain, France, Portugal, Belgium, Germany, Holland, Italy, and the United States proceeded to colonize most of Africa for more than 100 years, starting in 1885. Mainly to loot the continent's enormous mineral wealth.
This pillage continues today, especially in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, located in the heart of Africa. The DRC is one of the most mineral-rich countries in the world and holds an astounding $24 trillion worth of resources. The world's biggest copper, cobalt, and coltan deposits, along with gold, iron, and diamonds. Coltan is a particularly valuable mineral essential for the manufacture of cell phones, smartphones, computers, drones, and other military hardware. The Congo contains 80% of the world's coltan.
To obtain these minerals cheaply for Western corporations, the United States government has subjected the people of the Congo to a horrifying war for the last 20 years. The war has killed 7 million Congolese. The DRC has been repeatedly invaded by its neighbors Rwanda and Uganda, who act as U.S. proxies, looting the Congo's minerals.
In the mining zones, rape has been used as a weapon of war on a terrifying scale. 400,000 women a year are raped in the Congo. Bodia Babuidi is from the Democratic Republic of the Congo and is doing her PhD in women and gender studies at the University of Toronto.
The rape of the Congolese women is inextricably linked to the rape of the land. The rape of the Congolese women is a hacking in the womb of a nation. Rape means taking away their land, thus ripping them from their habitat, their communities, as well as the sources of basic needs for living. And this is being destroyed totally. Rape is also a biological weapon, as most of them suffer from various irreparable conditions and sexual transmitted diseases, such as HIV and others. Finally, rape is instilling terror while impacting the psychological well-being of many generations to come. We have women who are being raped in front of their children, women who are being asked to sleep with their father-in-law, sons who are being asked to sleep with their mothers, gang raped. So when we see such a thing happening in a people, or to a people, to a community, in a collective group, what happens to the generation to come? What happens to these boys, to these girls?
The Congo War, like many other wars fomented by men, is femicidal, meaning mainly directed at raping and killing women, and is the result of the West's boundless greed for wealth, in this case, the minerals essential to the electronics and military industries. Western military power and the high standard of living of many Westerners is to a significant extent based on the rape and genocide of Congolese women.
On Wings, you are listening to A History of Male Violence from the series Women, the Oppressed Majority. The hosts are Kristen Schwartz and Asad Ismi. Here's Ladytron with Destroy Everything You Touch.
In Canada, as it is in the Congo, the rape of the land and the rape and murder of women are very much related. In a massive genocide, European settlers killed 97% of the indigenous population of Canada and the United States, which totaled more than 15 million people. Such killing was done mainly to steal and plunder native land. Ethnic cleansing continues on a lesser scale in Canada today, with likely 4,000 Native women being murdered or missing, which the Canadian government has refused to deal with in an effective manner. No one has been punished for these murders, so they are likely to continue.
At the same time, Native communities across the country are being endangered by destructive corporate oil exploitation on their land, and especially by the enormous tar sands project in Alberta. Canadian corporations are also pursuing the building of pipelines across the territories of hundreds of Indigenous nations, threatening them with deadly oil spills.
Tanya Capo is a Native Canadian activist prominent in the campaign to raise awareness about the murdered and missing Indigenous women. Capo is one of the leaders of the Native group known as Walking with Our Sisters, which has created a traveling exhibit that honors the murdered and missing women. Capo belongs to the Sturgeon Lake Cree Nation in northern Alberta. She has also been involved with Idle No More, the indigenous movement committed to the protection of waterways and opposed to the construction of oil pipelines on native land.
A lot of people take a look at Canadian history and think of all of that stuff as something that happened in the past. And Indigenous people are often told, well, you know what? Get over it. Move on with your life. That happened before. And I'm always saying, you know what? No, it's not history. It's something that still exists. Even though attention is being paid to the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, they continue to go missing and murdered at record numbers. So how could you say that this issue is historic and we should get over it when it continues on a daily basis and the dangers increase for Indigenous women in general?
The Canadian government's response to the murders of Indigenous women is an example of the same colonialism that has led to the murders themselves.
I think that's certainly the perception of Indigenous people out there, is that the government is not taking this issue seriously enough, that all that's looking at this issue is an issue of crime. So because it's a criminal matter in their minds, it's up to the police to deal with it. They're not looking at it as a societal issue, that it's an attitude of society and generations of colonization and needs to be looked at through those lenses. What are some of the causes to this? You know, certainly there's a lot of factors that need to be considered. And in the RCMP report, they talked about these vulnerability factors, but they didn't go far enough to talk about what created the vulnerability factors. It's a history and a current ongoing state of colonialism.
The murders of Indigenous women are part of a larger genocidal assault on Native peoples by the Canadian state and corporations, focused mainly on stealing the little land they still possess.
Indigenous people, for sure, I know a lot experience situations that can, I would argue, be defined as genocide efforts, such as the removal of children from families, the removal of people from their land base to make room for industry and all those resource extraction activities, all of the pipelines, the tar sands, you know, it's all related.
The surest way to destroy a nation is to kill its women.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that a lot of people don't talk about enough, I think, as they should, is what are the role of Indigenous women and what are some of the reasons that they are targeted. And that certainly is one that is spoken about when the subject does come up, is that it's because they're the mothers of the nations. That's how the nations are going to continue, is through the women.
There's an epidemic of violence, not only against Indigenous Canadian women, but against Canadian women in general by men. According to the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, one-third of women in Canada have suffered sexual assault. Only 1 in 10 incidents of sexual assault are reported to the police, and less than 1 in 100 of such incidents leads to a criminal conviction. The cost of this violence is $9 billion a year, and this figure has more than doubled since 1995.
Margaret Alexander is professor in the Assaulted Women and Children Counselor Advocate Program at George Brown College in Toronto. She points out that violence is built into not only male-dominated mainstream Canadian culture, but into the very concept of masculinity.
Our cultural norms involve violence. They involve winning. They involve the ways that you resolve conflict is to win. And all kinds of ways that physical violence is celebrated, and you know, for some people, you want to win your way. You need to be on top, and how you enforce that is through violence, and it could be physical violence, it could be emotional violence, intimidation, all those kinds of things, punishment. I think also that we certainly gender people into these, you know, two genders, male and female, and that part of gendering somebody as male involves, you know, the thing that we call masculinity. And masculinity very much embodies this idea of being stronger and faster and in control.
For Margaret Alexander, this culture of violence against women has an economic basis.
I would associate violence with systemic oppression and colonialism as an enterprise that is concerned with access to resources. If you look at the roots of why systemic oppression is required, you can, as they say, follow the money, follow the resource, the root of all evil, if you will. So I think about this idea of Canada being a society that very much is stratified, and this idea of separating people into categories that are really much based on superficial characteristics. And through that categorization, you can determine who will have access to resources and wealth. And I think that when you think about colonialism as an enterprise, certainly it's about resources and wealth, right? How do you get rid of the people who have access to the resource so that you can have access to the resource? And so you've got to engage in the systematic devaluing of these people.
Patriarchy devalues and controls women by enforcing its expectations of how women should behave and present themselves. Women who live their lives differently, especially lesbian, bisexual, and trans women, are subject to punishment even as children. Angie Umbach is a lesbian and coordinator of the Rainbow Rights Project in the Philippines. She is part of a research team that has investigated gender-based violence in Japan, Malaysia, Pakistan, the Philippines, and Sri Lanka.
When we say gender-based violence, we don't talk about violence committed against women who are typical. We also call to mind the violence that is committed to people because of gender choices they've made. And this includes LGBTs. The gender-based violence is an oppression that is done because of what they feel women should act as, women should do. This mentality is what feeds into the violence. We did a research on violence against lesbian, bisexual, trans women. One of the most surprising results of that research is the interface between LGBT rights and child rights, where many of the instances of sexual violence committed against trans women happened when they were children, when they were oppressed because of what people perceived their sexuality would be. When kids as young as 8 years old, absolutely no idea about sex, are told that as deviants, there are expectations of them, and these expectations include being raped. Many of these instances are incest rapes. The number one violator is the family, because that's where most of the physical abuse and the mental abuse is happening. But the second most prevalent violator is the employer, because not only are LGBT women not hired, they also don't get promoted. They are also not treated well in their offices. They don't get access to toilets and common areas. And when other employees mistreat them, the employer looks the other way.
Women are not just victims of genocide, wars, and murders. They have also led successful struggles to end such brutality. In Argentina, women led the movement to save an entire country from a vicious 7-year-long military dictatorship, which killed 30,000 people for their political beliefs. The brave Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo were the main opposition to the generals and demonstrated against the dictatorship while it ruled from 1976 to 1983. Calling for the return of their daughters and sons who were kidnapped and killed by the military. Veronica Gago is a member of the Citiciones Collective in Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina. The collective carries out political research in collaboration with social movements.
Bueno, hay un antecedente muy fundamental que hay que tener en cuenta.
There is a fundamental precedent, which are the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. That is, the mothers of militants, both men and women, who were disappeared or captured during the dictatorship and in the midst of the dictatorship. The mothers organized themselves politically. They were the first and the bravest who confronted the dictatorship and began to denounce worldwide what was happening in Argentina with state terrorism. They were the most radical in maintaining the slogan, "We will not reconcile," truth, memory, and justice. They were part of a movement that later was expanded by different human rights organizations, but in a way, they were the pioneers in Argentina of the human rights movement.
The uncompromising stance of the mothers ensured that hundreds of the military officers responsible for the massive killing in Argentina were brought to justice and jailed. This, in turn, helped make Argentina a progressive nation ruled by elected leftist governments for 12 years, from 2003 to 2015. The profound political influence of the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo can be seen in the fact that from 2007 to 2015, Argentina has been ruled by a leftist woman president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner.
There is something of a social awakening that has allowed for a woman to seek and hold presidential power. 10 or 15 years ago, this would have been unthinkable.
You've been listening to A History of Male Violence, the first episode of the documentary series, Women, the Oppressed Majority.
Women, the Oppressed Majority is dedicated to the memory of Queen Nzinga, ruler of the nation of Ndongo, known as Angola today. She successfully resisted Portuguese colonialism and slavery for 40 years, from 1624 to 1664.
Many thanks to Dr. Maria Paez Victor for translating the interview with Veronica Gago and to Susie Alvarez Pocasangre for voiceover.
This documentary was funded by Canadian Union of Postal Workers National, Public Service Alliance of Canada, Ontario Public Service Employees Union, Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, Canadian Union of Public Employees, QP Local 3903, QP Local 4400, Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association, Canadian Labour Congress, Ed Finn, and Don Schmidt.
Thank you for listening.
Wings thanks Kristen Schwartz and Asad Ismi for sharing their series, Women, the Oppressed Majority. This has been Part 1, A History of Male Violence. The program was edited to fit Wings' time restrictions. Email wings@wings.org for a link to the original version or to hear any Wings program again. Thank you to Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.